Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Yeah, it was always a good block, to be fair.
Welcome back to Tier 3. It might sound late, but it's actually not, because we went a little bit later due to EFL Cup. I want to call it the EFL Cup, Chris. It's Carabao Cup, is it?
Yeah, nice big healthy glass of Carabao.
Now, I've got to admit, Carabao have been good to me in the past by getting me an interview with Antonio Conte, so I'm kind of favourable towards them. But they've had some bad PR so far this season. However, now the big teams have stepped in, this is even more of a thorn in most big team sides.
It's not ideal. The thing is, the start of the Premier League season with this included, I mean, it's always been this way with the League Cup. But yeah, it's a lot of games in a short space of time, which if you're in good form, that's a huge blessing, because it lets you further build the momentum and give a lot of tests to fringe players and things like this, which some clubs have done this evening. At the same time, if you're not in the greatest of form, I mean, Brighton's probably a decent example. They've had an okay start to the league. They've played 120 minutes down at Bournemouth tonight, and then they have to go home and play a fairly informed Newcastle side on Sunday. So it's not ideal for Chris Hughton.
No, certainly not. And of course, there's some other surprises tonight. What most people would have put in the form table as another loss for Crystal Palace, actually, they got away with a 1-0 win in the end, obviously at Selhurst Park, Chris, and obviously maybe neither side will have prioritised this one, making it a bit more of a level playing field. But great for morale around the club in the first place, and great for Roy Hodgson to get an early win under his belt. And
definitely,
the goal.
the goal is the most important thing, you could argue. It came from Sacco, who hasn't been as involved, but I would argue, looking at what Hodgson did at Fulham and things like that, a player like Sacco represents an important piece or an important cog. That's the thing with Palace. They've got him, Townsend, Zaha as well. So they've got some decent attacking pieces out wide that you would think will fit perfectly with Benteke. But by all accounts, Ruben Loftus-Cheek was the more impressive player. I think it was Tim Sherwood compared him to a Rolls-Royce. And I think if you even look at the Southampton game, I know they lost.
Tim Sherwood doesn't know what a Rolls-Royce is.
I mean, even though they lost that game against Southampton, I thought Loftus-Cheek came out of it with his head held high, because he's a good driving midfielder. I don't think he's maybe the most technically gifted midfielder to come out of Chelsea, but I think his ability to break the lines and things like that is an important skill, especially for a team that's going to play in the way that I imagine Palace will do under Hodgson.
Certainly was a difficult start for Hodgson as well, though, wasn't it, Chris? I mean, they showed, I don't want to say improvement, because actually I think it would be very difficult to judge what improvement is from De Boer to Hodgson, considering we saw such a small sample size. But we saw Royisms throughout this team, and we're likely to see even more Royisms, because unless he's gone through a very unconventional late career shift, it's going to be interesting to see. But I mean, you know, at the same time, are we going to see anything different, do you think, from Roy Hodgson?
You mean compared to what we're used to?
Well, maybe compared to, I mean, England might be a bit of a unique example as to what we are used to from Hodgson. What I know about Hodgson from maybe reading interviews past players over the past week and that sort of thing, which I think are probably more insightful than journalists just sort of guessing at what he might do, trying to replicate England, is, you know, drilling teams hard and giving a front three, great podcast, a bit more freedom. And maybe there's a sort of a winning formula there, considering the pieces that Crystal Palace have at their disposal. But, you know, at the same time, maybe Roy Hodgson also lacks the implementation of that backbone that it feels like Crystal Palace need.
Yeah, I think that's the interesting thing. I feel like we have a very set idea of what Roy Hodgson is as a coach. And it's, let's be honest, it's defensive. It's not taking risks. A lot of the things that Sam Allardyce outlined in that survival plan when he did an interview with Sky Sports, not taking risks in your own half and that sort of thing. But really, if you look at his time with England, I'm not saying that it entirely went against the grain, but there was the moment where he employs the diamond, I want to say against Germany, where they win, I think, is it 3-2 with the Vardy sort of flick goal? That was fairly expensive.
Second to his Iceland moment.
I mean, that's the thing. That was fairly expansive. It was fairly different. It was certainly shunting convention or shifting away from it. I think for him, what has always kept him in work, I mean, look, he's 70 and I've seen pieces saying, you know, it's criminal that he has a job in football, and, you know, it points to a lot of what's wrong with the management circle. The reason he stays in work is because of his pragmatism and ability to gauge what a team's level is. So he's not going to try and have a West Brom, a Fulham, a Palace playing like he would maybe with England, where he feels like he could employ a diamond and be quite expansive. He'll find what their limits are and keep them well within that, which is not the most exciting if you're a supporter, but it will keep you in the league most years. And I think for Palace, that's what they're looking for right now. They're looking for survival. They're not looking for anything else, because I think what dawns on every club at some point when you've become semi-stable in the league is just how reliant you are on that money that comes with it.
I mean, it's certainly interesting to think about the different factors in there. Will Roy Hodgson be able to mesh with some of those guys? Or because of the sort of, I don't know, I don't really know about Roy Hodgson's heart or true heart in that sense. But it's certainly going to be interesting to see what happens with the way he builds a relationship with that team. Because there's certainly other players out there who highly rate the way that Roy Hodgson builds relationships with players. Having said that, that means it's a 50% win rate so far for Roy Hodgson. Exciting and surprising. Maybe all in the same package, Nico, as someone like West Ham, who tonight were inspired by Marko Arnautovic to beat Bolton 3-0. And sort of, there is the beginnings of the embers of what we recognise of West Ham every season, where they're either incredible or awful.
Yeah, and I think there's instances where maybe people have overinflated the problems that West Ham seem to have, given their current form and the way that they've gone in the league and how it's seemed to consistently go down ever since Slaven Bilic's first season at West Ham. But, you know, this is a game where, you know, you feel like the greater opposition was always going to win the match, and that certainly seemed to be the case. Whether they continue that form in the competition remains to be seen, but it's an area where maybe they can return to form and maybe have a little bit of success that for fans that have been expecting it ever since people felt like they should be pushing on from their great experience a few seasons ago.
Let's go to Liverpool. I mean, let's go to Leicester, but let's go to Liverpool to talk about some of the post-mortem, Chris, that's going to be taken out of these last three games. Two draws, one loss, one of those to Leicester City. They lost 2-0, having heavily rotated a team and bringing in a backline which consisted of Joe Gomez and Ragnar Klavan at centre-back, and two fullbacks who were left exposed at times by the midfield that sat just ahead of them. The changes will definitely mean that you can't expect the consistency which you maybe want a Liverpool team to have. But again, it's people going back to the same old narrative, which people seem to be writing, of they don't finish at one end and they don't keep goals out at the other. But there seem to be signs all the way in between that they should be able to do both.
Yeah. I mean, they created, 34, 35 attempts against Burnley at the weekend. So I think... I mean, this is where, you know, your expected goals can come in and give you an idea on the quality of those chances, because I think when you do make it so binary like that, it can lead you to false realizations or false intuition. And I think, at the other end of the field, it's so easy to turn around and say that Liverpool clearly need to go and sign a centre-back, you know, Virgil van Dijk, whoever, and get them in, and that'll fix things. I question at this point if there isn't a greater issue, which is the attacking formation and the way that they play actually leaves their defence exposed and in bad positions. Because one of the things I noticed...
It's an interesting idea there, Chris.
Well, this is one of the things I noticed, that when we analyse van Dijk, the Southampton line, I wouldn't say is like chronically deep, but it's going to play deeper than, say, a Liverpool line is. And I think you find that a lot of the time when clubs buy a defender from lower down in the league, and they then have to play usually with a better teammate, definitely, but also higher up the field, that means you have more space to potentially make mistakes. And I know that sounds quite a Mourinho take on things, that, you know, it's about mistakes and not the confidence in your ability. But I think that would be an interesting transition for Van Dijk, which is suddenly he's having to play maybe closer to the halfway line than he's used to. And how does he adapt to that? And how does he spot the danger and things? And that's where I think Klopp has to come in. And I wrote this very notion this week for you, Max, that I think he has to become more pragmatic. I think he has to game manage a bit more, in the same way that we gave Pochettino credit for against Dortmund. He has to sit there and say, okay, what's the best way to break this team down? What's their weakness? It's not just a case of we'll play with the way we play and we'll bowl them over anyway. Because I think that's too naive in today's game.
I see elements of that coming through in Klopp's game every now and again. You see them trying to make more crosses from certain positions. You see Liverpool trying to make the 1-2s on the edge of the box. You see there are elements of that coming into the game. Maybe not as much as people would like, but seeing that element is definitely good. And then also seeing some of the, for want of a better word, sort of freestyle football that Liverpool put together. At times, some of the passing is great, and we saw that against teams like Sevilla. But then at the other end, Nico, I mean, I guess there's also a problem that if you analyse the goals that Liverpool conceded against Sevilla in their first match back in the Champions League group stages for quite some time, people said that there's a real problem with the system here. And I have no doubt there are issues with the system, which left maybe Liverpool and Lovren in particular exposed. But the first goal Liverpool conceded, definitely a mistake from Dejan Lovren. And the second goal Liverpool conceded, definitely a sloppy moment, and less about the system, more about, again, an individual mistake. And that's something that Klopp is going to be confident that he can coach out.
Well, and not necessarily even coach out, but as you mentioned, the first goal that Liverpool conceded against Sevilla, I mean, you can't, when you're walking around, you know, the streets and you trip, that's not something you consciously do. It's an accident. And so a lot of people, I think, made more of that mistake than was necessary. But I think
they will have made more of that mistake because it had a massive implication on the game. Maybe if it hadn't have had that massive implication, becomes more forgivable.
But I think the reason that people talk about it so much is because it goes along with the narrative and the consistency of the mistakes that people feel like are coming from the likes of Dejan Lovren and some of the defenders for Liverpool. And so I think, as you know, someone that likes to look at the numbers and someone that likes to analyze teams, and you know, you say, and I've written something on Liverpool about their system exposing their defenders, and while I certainly still hold that to be true, I think at the same time, if we look at the teams that they tend to concede against, it's the teams that, you know, sit deep and look to cede a lot of chances against them. And somebody actually mentioned on Twitter, looking at the expected goals, now that it is a little bit more mainstream and a lot of people are taking their own interpretations of it, said that, you know, one of these days Liverpool is going to beat Burnley 4-0 playing exactly the same way that they always do. And that's because they feel, you know, given the expected goals and the new metrics, that Liverpool always create chances against teams no matter what. But it seems to happen consistently against these teams that they just don't go in and then they get countered upon. And I think maybe this is the point I'm trying to make, where this is perhaps where the holes in some of these these metrics come to the fore, in the sense that the teams that they tend to do extremely poorly against, that they should do better against, are teams like Sean Dyche's Burnley, and teams like Leicester, that they defend in weird ways, in the sense that they cede possession, they cede shots from areas that teams normally are not comfortable with, and yet they apply the defensive pressure in a way that the shot, regardless of its good position, is a poor shot. And so I think this is, a possible gray area for Liverpool, where, obviously they have the individual mistakes from the defenders, but at the same time, their lack of ability to score win against some of these teams like Burnley and like Leicester are because, it's a more complex issue to some extent.
I also think there's big cultural problems maybe at Liverpool for a manager like Klopp. And I think, I kind of flagged this when he first came in, that I worried that his style of football was very appealing, but at the same time left Liverpool open. And it's definitely that sort of come to be true. And I that's less that I think I'm some sort of great analyst. I think it's just more that I come from growing up around a Benitez style of football rather than, a Klopp style of football. And even when Liverpool pushed for the title in the 13-14 season against City, I still sort of lamented the idea that it wasn't this lockdown, risk-averse football. And I think at times that has a tendency to magnify what's going on for Liverpool. Having said that, all the people who have played them have exploited it exceptionally well. And Leicester also scored some good goals. So,
But wouldn't you say that it's almost... we're overlooking the fact that maybe, you spoke about how you didn't like the fact that Liverpool over the past few seasons, whether it was with Klopp or not, have not necessarily maintained a sense of risk first, mitigating the risk kind of football and more risky stuff. And that, I think that really speaks to the hiring of Jurgen Klopp from Liverpool, is that, they know that they maybe didn't either want or have the financial resources that some of the other clubs in England who want to win things do. And so they go out and they get a coach that is the quintessential, image in world football at the time of trying to overachieve, and overachieving past opponents that have more money. One of Jurgen Klopp's most famous quotes is, Bayern have a bazooka and we have a bow and arrow, and we're shooting the same target. And so I think we can criticize Klopp, and certainly I have, for his lack of ingenuity, and that may well be something that never wins Liverpool a title under him. But at the same time, it is to his credit that we're speaking about Liverpool in consistent terms of being within the top four, being within the Champions League, and doing those things because of his overachieving style of football. And maybe without him, Liverpool will continue to be the fifth, sixth, seventh place team that they were before.
All right, mate.
I didn't mean that to be a dig at you, but you know what I mean. Like, they are.
I think a lot of people have to accept where Liverpool now find themselves coming from and going to, and maybe the intimidation that Klopp wants to be there at times doesn't feel like it's there, because actually, I think.
But you made the point as well that some of these signings, like this summer window without Klopp, is, I think you said it, not disappointing, but it does have a different shade to it than if Jurgen Klopp isn't there, right?
Completely. I think that, so there's every cloud, or there's also two sides to every paper narrative. And sometimes I think more of it is about us just having something to say on a podcast rather than having something significant. However, I'm not putting down what you said. I think you wrote a great article. It's well worth a read. And I think it's on our Twitter feed a number of times. So go take a look at it there, guys, at the front three. Tottenham also got away this weekend, Chris, with a 1-0 win against Barnsley. This also, though, was on a quiet night at Wembley. And again, people seem to be building this idea that Wembley just isn't Tottenham's location.
Juan Foyth, I think I'm saying that correctly, came in as well, which is an interesting signing, really. I mean, Pochettino's Argentinian, so obviously knows the league like the back of his hand. It was interesting to see him come in. I think that's the thing. Spurs, as much as we gave them credit, self, me especially, for game managing the Dortmund match, I do question if they're still being slightly hampered by the fact they don't have a conventional winger in the team. So they have the likes of Son and Sissoko, who can play wide, but they're a little bit kick and rush merchants when it comes to dribbling. They're not tricksters, or they're not like a Wilfred Zaha, for example. And I think that really stifles them, because if you're
Does that not come down to the fullbacks? Sorry to interrupt. Is that just not?
It can to a degree. I mean, that's where Aurier presents an interesting change potentially, because again, he'll give them that kind of Kyle Walker experience from right wing back. The difficulty I have, and I can say this having played at fullback, expecting someone to kick and rush it, it's a lot easier to defend than if they're running at you doing tricks and step overs and potentially twisting you one way and the other. I'd much rather play against a winger who is faster but less tricky, if that makes sense. And the difficulty I think that Spurs have had is finding that player, because they wanted Wilf Zaha, they bid for him, but Palace said no, they got Sissoko in. That didn't really work, still isn't working. In fact, I think Sissoko's looking a little bit heavier than when he was in his best.
Probably.
And so after that, you're looking at maybe Keita Balde, who ended up at Monaco. And, you know, you're going to spend a lot of money for a winger there, which is a big ask on a team that already has a lot of good players in it. I mean, you know, Son is not always starting, but is still a key influencer. Dele Alli has to fit in there. Eriksen has to fit in there. So it's a team, I think, that needs that kind of variety that a top four side usually has, but is wrestling with the fact that it doesn't have the financial clout to necessarily be able to accommodate that kind of player. If it can, it's trying to rely on its youth academy and the likes of, say, Josh Onuma. But even then, I don't think those players are at that level, the Harry Winkses and Josh Onumas. And Pochettino, in fact, again, I did something on this week about how it's difficult for him to develop those players because he doesn't want to loan them out, because in his eyes, he doesn't want lesser coaches working with them. Which, you know, it's I said in the piece, you know, it's quite admirable. I mean, you could argue it's a little bit pretentious at the same time, but it doesn't help those players' development when they're just sitting watching every week. They need to be playing. They need to be experiencing things. And that's the quandary, I think, that Pochettino has locked himself in at this precise moment, is they don't have the money to go out and waste another 30, 35 million. They've got to be sure. And even then, what is 30, 35 million going to buy you in the current market? Is it going to get you a game changer? My gut instinct says no, unless you're really doing some due diligence and taking a little bit of a punt on a player from a lesser league.
Elsewhere in the Premier League, Nico, a fantastic win for Man City again. Can you also, after we've obviously pointed out so many great positives for Man City, is it also worth flagging about the great start that Man City had last season and comparing the two?
Yeah, certainly. And I think, but I think the difference really between those starts, and really I say those because this is actually technically the worst start to a season that Manchester City have since I think the 13-14 season, because City have been great in the opening 5 to 10 games because of the experience that they tended to have and really well-known players in terms of they knew the league really well, and they understood each other really well, and they had played together for a long time. But I think the difference here is that the excellence that City have been putting out on the pitch early in the season hasn't been down to an experience, because the lineup has been relatively varied and the system has changed and they've done different things tactically, and it hasn't been down to the individual traits of certain players. It's really been down to the things that the coach has done and some of the things that they're doing tactically. So I think, you know, If there's a comparison to be made, it's a different type of success that I think they're having in the early season as opposed to the season before, where that wasn't sustainable across a long period of time, as we saw in previous seasons. Whereas now it's a little bit different.
So what in particular are you enjoying about this City side?
I think the versatility is probably the best thing because maybe as Chris mentioned, I think, you know, like he said, Tottenham maybe struggle from a lack of having a wide player, but that is often not really how the best teams tend to attack. You know, the fullbacks hold the width because the most efficient and deadly way to attack a team is centrally. And that's really what I liked about City throughout the season and specifically against Watford, you know, having Kyle Walker and Benjamin Mendy hold that width and then using someone like Raheem Sterling in a central position, you know, although he scored a penalty and he was really influential throughout the game. The Watford players found it really difficult to deal with him in central areas because he is so influential, but also him roaming and doing different things on the ball took the pressure and maybe some of the attention away from the likes of David Silva and Kevin De Bruyne. And when you can have those players a little less focused on, that's a recipe for success. So I would say the versatility, because I think you have a performance like that where so much of it is through the fullbacks, and really so much of City's success right now is because of the athleticism and versatility that those players offer. At the same time, there's a different game plan that can be implemented when you have someone like Leroy Sané and Raheem Sterling holding the width, and then you can do things differently in the middle.
I was certainly going to say there's an interesting side to this. Having been part of a Man City fan base for a while now, do you think there is a different confidence that comes with a Pep Guardiola building than any of the previous iterations of this Man City uber wealth?
Certainly for myself there is, because I think unlike other managers, specifically Manuel Pellegrini, I think there's a genuine sense of intention when we do certain things on the ball and we do certain things on the pitch, is that you can see that there's, and that's maybe the thing that I most enjoy about analyzing tactics, is that there is a specifically with Guardiola, is that there's specific causes and purposes to what the players are doing in every sense. You know, there's a purpose to the positioning, there's a purpose to a lot of the movement and passes, and everything really works in a certain way. And when it doesn't come off, it can be frustrating. But at least you know that there's a genuine blueprint, whereas maybe under other coaches, and this is something that some people praise and maybe someone like myself doesn't like, it's a little bit more free-flowing and there feels like there's less intention. So I think in that sense, there's a different sense of confidence with this Manchester City team. But yeah, I would say it's really enjoyable to watch and definitely different under Guardiola.
Chris, elsewhere there was something which we originally wanted to start talking about on the Pogba, the first time we started to try and record it, but then that didn't happen, was Chelsea versus Arsenal. Ended 0-0 at the end at Stamford Bridge, and Arsenal find themselves, I think, being the first team that stopped Chelsea scoring a goal at home in something like 29 games. And that's part of the what people seem to be coming away from with this match is the positives of having a more sure defence and a much more solid base of midfield, which seemed able to break down wave after wave of Chelsea, but also begin attacks of wave after wave against Chelsea and almost go toe-to-toe.
Yeah. I would agree with that. I think at the same time, it wasn't a great game.
No, it definitely not the most entertaining. Things broke down very quickly.
Yeah, that was the thing. It felt like they cancelled each other out. I think Wenger made a lot of smart tactical decisions. I think it would have been easy to go in full-blooded and include Sanchez and try and play in the way that he likes to, which is that sort of 4-2-3-1. But instead, he went for something that was, I think, a little bit more risky because he doesn't have necessarily the centre-backs to play a back three. But it paid off for them. And I think, you know, they had some good chances to win it. Lacazette, Mustafi, you're looking at a slightly different result there if those go the way of Arsenal. I think at the same time as I say that, there's definitely part of me that feels like it's like that's a highlight for Arsenal. Does that make sense? Kind of their expectations have been, I think, weathered so much that it's not a case of, okay, well, it's a decent point, but we have to build on it. It's very much kind of, this was a great game. We played really well. You look at a lot of Arsenal fans talking about giving Ramsey a 9 and a 10 and all this kind of thing. And yeah, they were good, but I also think that part of the reason they got that result is because Conte underestimated them. And there's always more than one moving part in these kind of situations. And I think that certainly Arsenal improved and they played better than they have in recent weeks. They, like I said, they also caught Chelsea off guard because I think Conte assumed that he could get away with playing Fabregas in the middle like that and not needing Bakayoko and the combination of Bakayoko and Kante to overpower that midfield and give them
control. Don't you think that a little bit of a cop-out, Chris, with Conte? Because I feel like the past few times that Arsenal have played Chelsea, it's been consistent successes for the most part, bar one or two results. And every time, you know, they tend to play each other, whether it's, you know, in the Community Shield or in the FA Cup final, it's like Conte gets away with it because he underestimated a player, or the players, you know, weren't ready for it because it was the end of the season or the beginning of the season. I mean, at some point, I think we have to give credit to Wenger, and I did certainly in the preview because I thought Arsenal were gonna win, in the sense that, you know, I think this is his doing. He understands what to do against Conte, and it's a shortcoming of Conte to not have adjusted by this point, supposedly being the better manager.
Yeah, that's in essence what I'm saying is that Arsenal, I think, improved. They definitely played better, but I think when I say underestimated them, I mean that as a criticism. Because it's against their opponent. They didn't factor in Conte specifically didn't factor in what he had learned from the FA Cup final, what he had learned from previous meetings. And that is a surprise given how often we see him be pragmatic and we see him adjust like he did after the loss to Burnley and things like that. So, yeah, I think it's not... When I say that he underestimated him, I don't mean, oh, you know, it was a small mistake. It was a big misstep from him, undeniably. And I think that's one of the reasons that even though it's still very early in the season, we're looking at one of the Manchester sides to drop the ball and take the title or give the title to the other one, rather than saying, actually, Chelsea look very good for retaining this. And part of that reason is things like that. The fact that he thought he could get away with that, that's a bad decision to make, undeniably.
I also think it's that he maybe was trying to get away with that because he's not quite sure on the shape of that front triangle yet and is slightly waiting for the reintroduction of Hazard on a more consistent fit basis. I mean, that's definitely part of it. And someone with a little bit different kind of movement to the movement that they already have. But I mean, we see your points about one of the Manchester teams dropping pace. And Nico, I mean, one team that at times, I mean, I watched the full game with Satman Dave on Sunday between Manchester United and an absolutely decimated Everton. But they were decimated late. And, you know, no matter how big the penis of any of the players in that team, there's still a sort of a Mourinho-esque fantasism which goes along with it. And there's something quite alluring about it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, people taking credit away from some of the Manchester United wins and maybe some of the Manchester United goals and saying that, you know, that they're not as valid, even though they clearly are, because they leave it late is I think a discredit to his team, who have done exceptionally well. And this Manchester United team have come so far from where they were last season in terms of the evolution of how they play their football. And I think regardless of when they score, it's really speaks to their credit as to, you know, the evolution of maybe Mourinho a little bit, in the same way that Guardiola has evolved a little bit to the Premier League, that the team is doing really well. And I expect the same results are becoming regardless of when the goals are scored, really.
Nice. Okay. Anyone got any opinions on the chant, which for weeks was going around? It's just banter, Nico. It's just banter. Having a big penis is of course something that anyone should be proud of.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's something that you really don't want to see, because it is, regardless of the I think the incorrect take that people are taking.
But, you know, he might have a big penis, because I mean, you know, powerful men have big penises. Do you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
And that's the reason people are saying, yeah, exactly. In that sense, he's very masculine. And if he had a small penis, he wouldn't score as many goals.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing that you want to see maybe eradicated from football, is this
small penises.
Is this overarching sense of hyper-masculinity within the game that is, you know, regardless of whether you think the racial stereotype or the cultural stereotype is a positive one, you know, Lukaku having a large or small penis. It's one that we, you know, is not appropriate for people to be chanting because there's so much more to Lukaku than having a big or small penis. And it's really not about that. And it's a chant that I don't think anybody should be proud to be chanting.
Is it, I mean, Chris, is that, this is going to be what's written in a lot of, and definitely what's going to be said on a lot of talk sport stations. And is that this is also going to be written in every sort of right wing and left wing newspaper, is that, you know, chanting is an affectionate thing. Chanting's about, you know, being close with a guy, and you know, it's about feeling like you know that guy. And there's an sort of uncomfortable air to the entire thing because we all know what the chant was about Lukaku, but at the same time, you know, we know what culture can be like sometimes, and the way that it's constructed can sometimes mean that it is inconsiderate, and it is, and those cultural stereotypes aren't. Do you know what I'm getting at here?
Just because it's portrayed as a positive trait does not mean that it's not racist or insensitive.
Yeah, and that's part of the problem, isn't it, though, is that they, you know...
It reinforces the stereotype of how we characterize black people and their sexuality. That's the problem.
And that's part of the problem, is that actually how many of the people singing that will be aware of that?
No, they won't, but that's because it's...
So does it have an air at all of sort of... And I, you know, I guess being part of this, sort of the liberal media sort of being like, well, look at these ill-educated guys singing and upsetting does that sort of comes across sometimes for me, which is also another side, which then makes me feel uncomfortable.
I don't think racism is defined solely by negative traits. That's what you have to understand here, is that, I mean, in the 1980s, there was a song about, I believe he was a striker called Franz Carr, who played for Newcastle. And it went something along the lines of, he's black, he's brown, he plays for the tune, something like that.
Yeah.
Now, that wasn't seen as racist, and Franz Carr didn't see it as racist. He saw it as quite a funny thing to sing about. The problem you have, though, is that, again, you're generalizing someone based on the way that they look. And in the case of Lukaku, you're generalizing that because he is... a black man, he clearly is well endowed, because that's the stereotype that's been sort of proliferated through media, through culture, all that kind of stuff. And that's what I think people need to grasp, is that at the same time, I don't think people objecting to it are looking to paint people as being ignorant or stupid or anything like that. I think what they're trying to say is, look, you need to show a little bit more understanding that not everything that you say about a different race, ethnicity, gender, whatever, that is positive in your eyes is acceptable, if that makes sense. And I think that's where we need to just show a little bit of evolution, if you will, a little bit of maturity, and say, well, hang on, just because this was acceptable when I was a kid, when my dad was growing up, whatever, that doesn't mean it's acceptable now. Our culture should always be evolving. It should always be growing and moving forward. And that might sound like a grandiose take for what is essentially a football chant, but I think in the long run, it's important we do that, because we have to remember that whether we think it or not, we're raising the next generation. And that's the difficulty, is that specifically in football stadiums, there is often a sort of acceptance of a lot of things that you wouldn't get away with shouting on the street, because it's like, well, it's just a football ground, you know, it's just, that's the done thing, whether it's actual racist abuse or whether it's homophobic abuse, all that kind of stuff. You just have to go to a ground in England and you'll hear that kind of stuff. I don't think we can any longer sit and just say, well, that's par for the course. There has to be a point where we stand up and say, okay, things need to change. We need to evolve. We need to push forward with this kind of stuff.
I love it when you answer my questions well. There are apparently also Manchester United related people urging the club to stop fans from singing what's now being referred to as, and weirdly, the Lukaku song. You'd think that people could get creative with his name a little bit more. Lukaku is surely a name to get creative with. Let us know your favourite football songs, which have got a tinge of awful undertones. There are plenty of them out there. I asked for that ironically. Don't at me. There were other games this weekend as well. And Chris, one of them was a Newcastle game. Newcastle got away with a win against Mark Hughes's Stoke. First of all, Rafa Benitez, the ultimate merchant of banter, shook Mark Hughes's hand for what felt like 4 hours.
Obviously, friend of the show, Elliot Hackney, is a Stoke fan, and he and I were DMing before the game.
He loves Andrew.
And I'll be honest, I had no idea which way the game was going to go. And even after the game, I was sort of like, I couldn't decide whether it was a deserved win, because I mean, Hosolu in particular had two or three really good chances that he fluffed. And it was a very close game. I think that's fair to say. There was a penalty shout in there that, I'll be honest, I still don't know if it's a penalty or not. I've seen enough people say both ways. But what I think you can take from it is, it's probably the most impressive of the three wins that Newcastle have put together.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Together, because for me, Stoke are the best of those three sides. The way the game managed the situation, I keep using that phrase, I know, but I thought they didn't try and outplay Stoke. They were happy to almost take those gegenpressing elements of winning it high and then starting counterattacks further up the field, which they did perfectly for the first goal. I think that defence, the fact it's allowed to sit a little bit deeper, stay a bit more compact, that really helps the players involved there, because they're all very good defenders at heart, but I don't know how good they are at actually playing the ball out. And then you have Mikel Moreno, who is, for me, growing in confidence with each game, is starting to understand the league a bit better. I think there's a lot of positives to take. They've got 9 points now. They took them until November 8th, I think, with Steve McLaren last time they were in the league to get that many. So they're on course for survival, which is the goal this season. But for Stoke, I think it was just, I don't know, I think they struggle from the fact they're not playing with a recognised forward. They have that front three, great podcast, of Hesse, Choupo-Moting, and Shaqiri, but there's no one kind of sitting there and serving as the link between the rest. And Shaqiri, to me, while he's a wonderful footballer,
he's not a 10, is he?
The few times I've watched him, he seems very willing to go into his own world where he just shoots a lot. And sometimes that works. I mean, the goal they score comes from him shooting on the edge of the box. But there's a few times where he goes high and wide and he's not that involved, and, you know, he can drift in and out of games. And I think you're, without wishing to sound disrespectful to Stoke, you're seeing why the likes of Inter and Bayern were willing to let him go, is because he's a little bit mercurial in both the best and worst ways. And I think that's where I feel a little bit for Stoke, is that they're just missing that link man up front, because I don't think it's going to be Berahino either. But you look at that back line and the midfield, and they've got enough experience and quality. Admittedly, they need two wing backs like yesterday, because I don't think Peters is one, and Mamed Bouramdouf is definitely not one as hard as he works. But there's definitely the foundation of a good side there. And I said before, I could see them being a surprise package, just because if it does click for them and the right things go their way, then they have more than enough quality to get there. I think they're just missing one or two pieces that maybe they could pick up in January.
Certainly is interesting. It's certainly interesting to see Benitez football back with a vengeance as well. You also just got to love Christian. Is it not Christian? Is that too? Let's just finish. Nico, I do want your take on Conte a little bit. I got your take on Emilia. I didn't get a chance to come back to you. With him going to be obviously changing things for the Carabao Cup, is this going to be the next phase of what we see with Conte? He needs to bring youth through at Chelsea. It looks like he can bring youth through at Chelsea. He can do this in the Carabao Cup. With him sort of, you know, acknowledging that they sort of stayed level and keeping the ship steady over the summer, you know, by signing Morata, being able to subtly transition Costa out of the side, etc., etc. Is this the next part of his management, that he can now begin to bring some kids through in the same way that Juventus would have liked to have brought Italians through, and etc., etc.?
I think there's certainly the opportunity for him to do so, but I don't think he will, given his past record at Juventus and the clubs that he was at previously. I think there's a call for him to sort of evolve tactically, and maybe some of the youth that is both out on loan and even still at the club, or some talent that is there right now that he has purchased, is offers him the ability to evolve tactically and push on and have similar to success to the one to the season that he had last year with Chelsea. But I don't see that he has the ability to right now, because, you know, it's all fine for me to say that it's time for him to evolve, but it's very difficult implementing that. But like I said before, I think there's certainly the opportunity for him to do so. But as to whether he will, I don't think it will be sort of in a more permanent sense. There's a possibility of him using this opportunity to bring some youth through and to try some different things tactically. But in terms of changing the side in a more permanent sense for the premier competitions, I don't think that will necessarily be the goal of what he's trying to do here.
Chris, let's go to Paris, or Paris-Dice, as a lot of people seem to be calling it right now, where there seems to be trouble in Paris-Dice, and Neymar and Cavani are not getting on particularly well for some weird reason. Neymar has allegedly unfollowed him on Instagram, which shows that they may not be friends, but also how petty one grown man who's trying to step out of the shadow of another grown man is.
Yeah, I feel like you'll keep me straight if my comparisons are off on this, but I feel as if it's a very important and early test for Unai Emery, because essentially what he has slowly, I would say, manifesting here is almost a LeBron in Cleveland type situation.
Lovely.
Not brilliant. Because of the attachment, but because of he clearly wants to be dictated to in every facet, and I could see the day where he's coaching on the sideline almost, even though he's obviously still playing. Yeah. And that's my concern, is that yes, they've spent an obscene amount of money to get him in there, and I think to a degree this is giving at least some credence to what Bartomeu, I'm sure Nico will tell me if I'm pronouncing that right as well, said about kind of him and why they maybe let him go, and those insinuations.
Bartomeu said a lot of
It's that idea, and it's timely because I just interviewed Mike Petke today about Thierry Henry, and it's almost a similar kind of situation, in so much as, do you pander to the star? Do you give them that adulation and acceptance and power that they want, or do you set a very strong and principled line and make it so they don't feel like they're special?
Which one's the star? I mean, I understand that the status here, but Cavani is surely also a star.
He is, but he's not on Neymar's level. That's the problem.
Why does it have to be either or? And this is a consistency that I find with a lot of the analysis with talent in England as well, is that, you know, people. Maybe when Carlos Tevez was around at Manchester City, felt like, you know, it was justified that a player didn't do certain things in training, or it was justified because of the mercurial talent of a certain individual in a team, that they could get away with doing certain things or not doing certain things that the team was allowed to do. And I don't feel like, I feel like, especially at a certain age and at a certain level of profession, there has to be a sense of, I guess, transparency in saying, listen, you're going to have to, I don't know how, maybe how to word that in the best way, but I don't see why it has to be either or in the sense that, you know,
so
you're
either not special or you are.
Well, if you were Unai Emery, go ahead.
Because unfortunately, that's the problem, is that it comes down to black or white. Either you pander to them and say, okay, you know, we'll take him off penalties, we'll do whatever you want, or you say, no, this is what's going to happen. Unfortunately, there is no middle ground in that situation, because he either takes the penalty or he doesn't take the penalty.
Or you just give the penalty to someone else.
Yeah,
well, maybe this speaks to the evolution of the manager that is required of Unai Emery, because at Sevilla, he obviously didn't have near the type of ego or the level of ego that he will be experiencing at PSG. And I guess it's, you know, I don't know what I would necessarily do in that situation, because I have no experience in the management realm. Certainly with the caliber of player that both Neymar and Cavani are. But I feel like there is possibly a middle ground with that kind of situation, because it just, I don't know if you designate the penalty taker yourself or if it's something that, because apparently previous to this, to the incident, he had told them to work it out, because there had been an incident previous to the one that sparked the issue.
There's the problem. Sorry to interrupt, Lawrence, yeah. But I think there's the problem in essence, is that when you look for that middle ground and you say, okay, look, you two, you're grown adults, sort it out. This is what happens. You have an instance where Cavani takes the ball, misses the penalty, and then Neymar is even more annoyed because he feels like he should have had the penalty.
But surely you can also then say, though, Cavani would maybe have taken a better penalty if he'd have been allowed by a supportive teammate to just focus on the penalty and not maybe put doubt in his mind. Surely the person who puts doubt in his mind should be an enemy and not someone who's supposed to be an ally.
Because of that. And I think that's, at the same time, I think, yeah, Emery could sit them down and say, look, we're not going to win anything if you two keep being individuals like this. You both benefit each other. You both have assets that will complement each other. So get on with it and play together. But at the same time, in my mind at least, and I'd be curious to hear listeners' opinions on this as well, the consequence for that has to be, look, if you can't play together, then we'll not play either of you. Yeah. But can you do that with two players that cost close to 300 million? I mean, the benefit he has is Mbappe is there too, who cost a similar amount and brings a similar theoretical level of quality. And
they don't have to like each other in order to play together in the same team, because as we've seen in the past, maybe with Suarez and Sturridge, there are plenty of instances, both heard and unheard, of players that have not gotten along off the pitch, but, you know, are required to be professionals in and of themselves and do something that's better for the team, especially with the caliber of talent that those two players possess.
I guess the issue is also, maybe there's a there are elements in there where both of them culturally maybe come from backgrounds where the personality is slightly more intertwined with the style that they have.
I mean, that's the thing. It was theorized that one of the reasons Neymar wanted to leave Barcelona was because he was tired of being the support act to Messi. He wanted to build his own star. So I'm not surprised that this has occurred. And at the same time, I think, yeah, there are examples of players that didn't get on. I always think of Andy Cole and Teddy Sheringham, who, from what I remember, Andy Cole didn't like Sheringham at all because of the way he greeted him or something when he was subbed on for England. And then you look at, say, Cole and York, who got on famously, and you look at the difference. And no matter what PSG do, if it goes sour, I would be inclined to sit there and think, imagine if those two actually got on, how much better it would be.
Well, yeah,
if they actually tried to work together.
Is it maybe also, and you know, we don't know all the facts, but this is the second consistent situation that Cavani has had with players at PSG, considering his relationship with Ibrahimovic was really bad. Also, they didn't like each other, and I'm sure there were reasons to that as well. But maybe. Perhaps we're pointing the finger at Neymar Cavani's the issue.
Well, I think if both of them are involved in it, then you can definitely point the finger at both. You probably also point the finger at Dani Alves, who hid the ball or sort of shielded the ball away from Cavani. You'd also say it's twice where Cavani has been told he is second to Neymar or Zlatan or whoever it is that you want to put ahead of him. And actually, I think in both those instances, he threatened the status of both those players.
Yeah, I mean, the problem that Cavani has, whenever he was given the spot, when Zlatan was injured at PSG, he didn't really take the chance, for my mind. And then you look at the weekend, he takes a penalty and he misses it. So there's definitely a problem, and I would say to a degree, an opinion or narrative, whichever word you want to apply, that Cavani is not the man for the big occasion, that when he's really needed to do something, it doesn't come for him.
Neymar also fluffed the free kick, which Cavani wanted.
Yeah, that's the problem. Is I don't think it's as deeply ingrained with Neymar at this point, though. He's still seen as a game-changing player that's world-class, whereas I think Cavani's seen as a good striker, but not a world-class one.
Nico?
But that's
because he'll miss chances and then score more difficult ones. Like Celtic was a good example. He scores a really difficult header, but he missed a much easier chance for, I want to say, Mbappe's goal in the first half. Like, he has a very polarizing opinion, I think, Cavani. Whenever you speak to people about him, he really does conjure a variety of opinions. And so when you want to be the star and you want to say, look, you know, this is my team, or I'm the diamond in the middle, you kind of have to deliver every time. It's a big ask. That's why I think no one questions choosing Messi over Neymar, because Messi always delivers pretty much. It's very hard to find times at club level when he hasn't been what he was said he would be.
That's a very good point. Nico?
Yeah, I would just, my only reply to that would be, I think the divisive opinion of Cavani that people often share is because, you know, I don't think people watch Cavani enough, because statistically throughout his career, he's actually proven that he is a fantastic striker. I mean, given the numbers, you know, him, Zlatan Ibrahimovic, and a few other players are really only the only ones in Europe that come close to replicating anywhere close to the type of goal scoring numbers that Messi and Ronaldo have. And I think for years we've had this supposedly divisive opinion of Cavani, and occasionally on the biggest stage, you know, there's the Arsenal game that comes to mind, where PSG played Arsenal last year, that, you know, he didn't finish a few chances. But I think it's one of those situations that he puts himself in positions where it looks like he's actually missed badly when he hasn't, and maybe it looks like he has failed to finish a decent chance when the chance was actually quite difficult. And the only reason that he got in that position was because of, you know, the attributes that are available to him, you know, his incredible athleticism and the way that he moves off the ball. So statistically, to me, Cavani has proven that he is a fantastic striker, and he deserves to, I guess, not be pushed out of the spotlight so consistently.
So if there are two sides to every story. Now, or maybe more than one narrative to be written. Now, let's go to Madrid. Not literally, though. That would also be lovely. Opening night of Atletico Madrid's brand new stadium, Chris. And it's a glorious structure. It really is quite a stadium.
I must confess, I haven't seen any pictures of it.
Have you not? They have been everywhere, Nico. Have you seen those very same pictures on social?
I have seen some of those. I think also the... if I'm correct, their highway system runs through the, like, under the stadium, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
So yeah, it seems like a stadium fitting of a team that has consistently achieved in Europe, and hopefully they'll actually see some European conquest there.
Something quite nice about being able to keep those kids or some of the guys around for the launch of this, and in particular players like Griezmann does seem to give it a slightly more hopeful launch. Nico?
Yeah, Atletico have really struggled at the beginning of the season, but I think with Simeone signing a new deal up until, I think, 2025, that sort of reinstates maybe the uncertainty around the club that people felt, because obviously they've enjoyed the majority of the success both in the league and in Europe under Simeone, and the enigmatic style of football that he's brought to Atletico. And I think with this new stadium, it's one of those things where it's a similar thing that Tottenham are trying to do, where they're, you know, although Atletico have had great pedigree in Europe and in the past, building a stadium like this and a stadium of that size really tends to cement a place, although it doesn't guarantee anything, and it obviously doesn't guarantee performance. You usually don't see teams of the caliber of that stadium struggling all that much. So I think it's a symbol of the consistency that they want to have, both under the coach and as a club.
Elsewhere, Chris, Cologne's weird week continue in the Bundesliga. They actually tweeted at God. So, I think something along the phrase of "Why? What have we done?" or "Why us?" After being absolutely thrashed in Bundesliga this week.
Yeah, it was pretty comprehensive by Dortmund, to be fair. You look at the Arsenal game, and I think it was a little bit of a false flag in so much as it was a huge game for the club from their perspective, because I think it'd been like 20 years or something since they'd last played in Europe. And so they really did get themselves up for that. And even then, they lost 3-1. So, you know, there's not much to take from it. I think it's just a very tough time for them at the minute because, you know, Cordoba's obviously leading the line and he's not the most prolific striker in the world, despite what that goal against Ospina would suggest. And so they have my sympathies, let's put it that way.
Elsewhere, Real Sociedad got beaten 3-1 by Real Madrid. Real Madrid's black and green kit, it really is something to behold. But if you're looking for a kit to buy, buy the training kit. It doesn't have the words Fly Emirates on the front. And until Fly Emirates, until I do Fly Emirates, I will try and find a training kit without those words on the front. It's certainly interesting. And Gareth Bale getting a goal in that one. Elsewhere, Dembele is set to miss out for Barcelona for, I think, 3 to 4 months, Nico. He was bedding in quite nicely. And when I say quite nicely, I mean just differently to Neymar, and showing the sort of difference in what he can bring to a team, maybe also how he's maybe more needed out on that sort of a position. But now he's out for 4 months, and the frustration there is that may leave them looking a little starlight, if not actually light up top.
Yeah, I think the consensus was he wasn't fitting in that well, and maybe the period that he would have enjoyed not being injured would have settled him better into the team, considering he doesn't really maybe play the Barcelona way and the way that Barcelona liked to play.
But I think that was part of the problem, wasn't it? That actually his performances weren't terrible, but the way that he was fitting in wasn't quite what they wanted. Do you know what I mean?
No, yeah, definitely. And I think there's that's almost to some extent, I'm not going to say that, you know, because the performances weren't bad, but I think there's a reason that they targeted him specifically and they wanted him as a player is because some of those things were by design. And I think with Valverde's system, a lot of that is, you know, focusing on a defensive aspect and the defensive pressing and some of the things that made Barcelona great in the first place, and then accentuating the best qualities of the likes of Messi and Dembele and letting them do certain things in offense that allow them to be a little bit more free. Obviously, I think there's tweaks of the system and things that he wanted to work on over the course of a year that would eventually hopefully hit the stride at the right time, maybe in Europe and in other competitions that, you know, would have fit best. And this injury doesn't necessarily fit that timetable. So it's a difficulty for him, but so far so good under Valverde. So I like what I've seen.
Chris, elsewhere in the football boxing world, Rio Ferdinand is, he's beginning to train to become a professional boxer.
Easy for you, sir.
Yep, he's it's ridiculous.
I think it's important to stress that he's not going through the traditional channel, so he's not getting a boxing license, and it's being I think orchestrated by Betfair.
Yeah,
I don't even know whether you should give them publicity really, because it's look, I have very conflicted feelings on this, because in an interview, Ferdinand said that he feels it could help him get through aggression and the loss of his wife to cancer and things like that. And for that element, yes, I think sport can be a very good cathartic facilitator for that kind of stuff. With that said, it does feel like a stunt because I saw how not nervous, but how trying to think the word, almost upturned noses sprouted up the second money was mentioned, how much he's going to be paid, because he is going to be paid by Betfair to do this. And there clearly is some financial gain, because I assume he's going to fight a proper boxer in the same way that chap from Geordie Shore fights proper fighters who are essentially just taking in their first pro fight when they step in the cage with him. And for that reason, I think it's just, I don't know, it's a bit like the Big Lebowski, isn't it? It's when he says, you know, you're not wrong, you're just an arsehole. I don't feel that strongly about it. But I also don't think it's this purist Bo Jackson type pursuit that, maybe he's trying to paint it out to be. I think he's doing something because it'll be fun and it's a chance for him to make a decent wad of money and maybe work through some issues that he has or some, depression that he has with his situation. But yeah, I don't think it's some pursuit of sporting excellence like maybe he wants to make out.
Elsewhere, it's well worth taking a look at the, they still call it the Golden Boy Award in 2017. Still a bit of a weird name, maybe it's a poor translation, but there are quite a few players from the English league in there. Joe Gomez, Dom Solanke, obviously other players of note, Pulisic, Reece Oxford is there as well, Ousmane Dembele, obviously. And there's Aaron Martin, Espanyol, and I think one Leipzig mention in there, Marcus Rashford, and Kyle Walker-Peters. Some people would say it's not the strongest list we've seen in a while, but there are certainly some promising names in there. Chris, if you could pick one of those guys out, who would you go for? I'm just almost inclined to go down the Rashford route.
Yeah, I mean, he's had the greatest impact.
Kasper Dolberg may also have had a similar impact. I mean, he's been very consistent.
He has. And he plays with a maturity quite similar to Eriksen. Look at me, Phil Neville, my way through this. But he does have that sort of maturity to him that I find quite impressive. For me, the one that I'm watching with most intrigue at the minute, personally, not to say that he's the best, is Dom Solanke.
He's shown
some flashes of stuff at Liverpool, and obviously to leave Chelsea, that's a big risk. I spoke to Mikhail Jongsma, who watched him a lot for Vitesse and wasn't really blown away by, I think, anything that he did. And yet he hasn't looked out of place, I think, playing for Liverpool. So I'm eager to see whether his potential is fulfilled or squandered, respectively.
He's had a couple of games where he almost scored but hasn't quite. You get the feeling he needs to get off the mark soon against Liverpool. Obviously, Kylian Mbappe is also in there. And the other potential big money move of the summer that didn't come off, of course, was Gianluigi Donnarumma, who is still at Milan. And then, obviously, Nico Gabriel Jesus. You might feel a little biased about him. Do you think he deserves a Golden Boy Award yet?
I don't know about award. I think he's maybe one of the more late, cases for the award there. But there are some excellent names. I think the obvious name that comes to a lot of people's mind is Kylian Mbappe. A lot of people feeling that he's going to win it. But I think the name that maybe I'm most impressed with is Amadou Diawara, if I'm saying that correctly. A Napoli central midfielder that I actually didn't know was that young. And, I mean, he stepped in for Napoli a number of times last season and looked, not a bit out of place. So I think he has a really promising future.
Let's also acknowledge someone who had a good performance over the weekend, and it was Lamina at Southampton, flagged on Match of the Day and analysed to within an nth degree of its life, but a fantastic initial ball-carrying, ball-winning performance from Lamina, and as a Liverpool fan who's looking for a player who can currently win the ball and carry it forward in the league, I have to admit an incredible amount of envy of what Southampton have bought there, considering the summer they've had, and also the fact
that it's strange that Juventus let them go.
Yeah,
because he was a real versatile player that played for them a number of times last season in the Champions League and the latter stages of the Champions League, and I think he's a really versatile player that can do a lot of different things in a lot of different positions. I think midfield is not the only place that we'll see him throughout his career. So I'm surprised that he made the move to Southampton in the first place. But if there's any place that you want to develop as a footballer, and not only that, but as a person, I think Southampton is the place.
Right before you join Liverpool.
Now, I'm not going to bring up Twitter, or at least I will bring up Twitter in just a second. But we have had some questions through. Chris, do you have access to the TF3 Twitter?
Bear with me one second, just logging in.
Oh, wow. You log out.
Taking the keys out and all that kind of stuff. Sure. No, I'm always logged in.
No, Chris is actually very paranoid about
security. I can pretend to be Adam and Dave at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
That's convincing. Yes, okay, I have it right in front of me.
Do you have any, what questions have we had come in? Because we did ask for some cues for the A's. The A's being the arseholes who will answer them.
Luke Dawe friend of the show and myself asks, who do you think will score in the Wembley Cup?
Well, that's a great question. I think Dan Cutting will score.
Am I right?
Who? EE. No, right? I like that. I thought you said Iggy. EE, definitely. I think I'd be inclined. Robbie Fowler has been one. I think Robbie Fowler will score. I actually think some of the captains, be that the F2 or Spencer, will get a goal. And I think it'll be, who's the number nine for hashtag United? By the way, the Wembley Cup.
Ryan Adams.
I think it's, yeah, Ryan Adams. I think he'll get a goal or two. I'll be interested to see how the back line of both sides deals with the attacking flair that both sides put out. I know a good thing, good friend of the show, good friend of ours all, Jimmy Conrad, is going to be playing for hashtag United. So it's going to be quite the star-studded event. And you can hear it exclusively commentated on by Brian Davis and Lawrence McKenna.
Lovely stuff. See, we have some good questions, but I don't know if we have time to ask them. Piotr Gala asks, what weaknesses do you see in your respective sides up to this point this season?
Lack of goals and leaky defence.
And what winter signings would you like to be made for them?
Lamina.
Wouldn't be bad, actually.
It wouldn't be bad, but it's not going to happen. I'd love Liverpool to re-sign Emre Can onto a long-term contract. And who else would I love to see them sign? Naby Keita early in January.
Nico, any Man City signings you're desperate to make or eager to make?
I'd like to see some of the Girona guys brought back, Aleix Garcia and Pablo Maffeo. But other than that, I think Manchester City fans have to be happy with the squad.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Carlos Zaldivar asks a very good question that I think could have its own pod. Is playing beautiful football important?
Bloody hell. No, not always. Although it's also subjective. What is beautiful?
That's a very good answer.
I was gonna say that. Yeah, I think oftentimes people can talk about pragmatism and the different styles of football as you know, beautiful football or simplistic football. When in reality, at the top level, both extremes of football have their own degree of complexity that can be subjectively beautiful or not.
Absolutely. And that's a beautiful way of putting it.
Pogpass asks, short but not so simple, Martial or Rashford?
Rashford.
But I really, really like the way that Martial carries the ball.
Yeah, he's a very beautiful player to watch. But overall, yeah. I think most people would rather have a Rashford in their team right now, in the Premier League at least.
Okay.
Rashford is blistering, though, in terms of pace, but Martial...
Yeah, he's fast.
Yeah, Martial, I think, maybe even outstrips him.
So Chinmay Deval asks about Neymar Cavani, but Packed Mouse asks, who's been the best bargain so far this season? Danilo would be my choice. That's him saying that, by the way, not me.
Good shout. What about you, Nico?
I'd be tempted to say James Rodriguez if I didn't think he unbalanced that Bayern midfield so much. But, you know, if they can work out those issues, then I'd probably say James Rodriguez, yeah.
It's a really good shout. There's a lot of names going around. Nemanja Matic surely has to be the token Dave mentioned here because he's been fantastic so far this season. Maybe even, I'm trying to think who else there is. I'm just looking forward to seeing Naby Keita now. So it's just that really gets in the way. Chris, anyone for you? Surely Moreno. Moreno was a big one.
Yeah, I would say Moreno. If we bought him tomorrow, he would cost I think 8 million, which is
good.
Peanuts in this market.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is a question or a statement. Bear with me.
Where's the podcast?
Yeah, I mean that. Don't get me wrong. That is asked. We're asked a lot about the Lukaku chat. Philip Oliver Mellons, who might I add has some very wonderful pit bulls, who are very adorable, asks why Lawrence is the type of guy that thinks his reflection is a Lawrence in a different dimension. I don't think that's a question. I could be totally wrong here. I had to read it a few times to understand.
It's a long-term meme. I mean, it's the same dimension. I get the concept of a mirror. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Alex asks, is Eden Hazard a better dribbler than Neymar?
Subjective? Probably not based on a highlight reel, but maybe in terms of consistency.
Maybe I'm wrong. I feel like this is a good one for Nico. Apologies if I get any names wrong here. It's someone with a unique name. I'm used to it. Tapiwa Musa, I think is how you say it. With Dembele out, what's the best option for Barca's front line, especially against Europe's best, considering De La Feu is highly undependable?
Good.
Nico, any strong answers for this one?
Is this me? I feel like the defensive approach that Valverde seems so fond of, sort of maybe the 4-4-2 diamond that Real used in the final last season against Juventus, or you know, the loose iteration of that is really the best, because I think when you have Suarez narrow and giving him the ability to roam, that's really a danger. And then who doesn't want to see Messi a little bit deeper, maybe in a more similar midfield role, because the type of ball that he can play over the top, and then the free role that he has and that he's enjoying at the current moment is something to behold. So I think that's where I would go with that.
Any good final questions, Chris?
There's one that is a slight lead off of that. It's because it's Barcelona themed. I'm just trying to pull his name up. I believe his name is Dara White. I'm guessing he's Irish, given the way it's spelled.
Could be Dara.
Yes, no, definitely good. And he asks, hang on, where has it gone? Oh, crumbs. This is awkward.
Is this the tweet?
No, he's not. It's me that's the idiot. The poor lad, he's probably thinking, yes, finally, I've got a question answered in this idiot, can't find it. Ah, there we go. It seems like Barcelona is turning into a club who does not focus on their academy as much anymore, but focus on outside sources.
I think that's been a prominent narrative for some time. You can still see academy players. I mean, it certainly is fair to say that there is a lot of criticism to be had of the hierarchy within the club. The fact they are still getting reasonable results during a time where people are massively questioning their acumen and their actual football expertise is certainly interesting. They seem to be straying from the rules set down by the men in the past. Doesn't mean they're necessarily wrong. And it does have the tendency to look from the outside like there are shortcuts being taken. But at the same time, there are other sides which argue differently. And they do still seem to be promoting young Spanish, if not Catalan, exclusively talent. Nico?
Yeah, no, I would agree with a lot of what you said. But at the same time, I think people talking about the lack of maybe concentration of Barcelona youth products is something that was an unrealistic expectation in the first place, as I've talked about before, because of how many they had at one particular point in time, when in reality the majority of clubs never have near that amount of success with their youth system. And I understand Barcelona have elevated expectations of their youth products and their youth academy, but realistically, unless they have better coaches than everyone else, which I think at this point in time they don't that's not necessarily the case, then you can expect the same out of their production. So I wouldn't necessarily even put that down to the hierarchy. I would just put that down to the coaching at the youth academy.
Excellent. Any closing questions, Kristen?
No, I think that's all. But what I would say to anyone who maybe didn't get this out, you can always DM us because our DMs are open.
Else will probably miss that utterly, but Kristen does make sure to pass them on very often.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, actually, I tell you what, our good friend Kenny J. Rubello, who, by the way, I keep meaning to say on the podcast, is an aspiring semi-pro footballer.
Nope.
Doing good things with Dallas City FC. I keep watching his Instagram stories and things. It's really fun.
Great, yeah.
He asked, should captaincy be decided as a matter of meritocracy, position on the pitch, or how long a player has been at the club?
There are arguments for each. You've got to say that they suit different management styles. I think it depends on how it's explained. From my perspective, it depends on how it's explained to the players, but also the fans, and what your club looks for in a captain. And you know, so for instance, there's a lot of frustration around Jordan Henderson maybe being Liverpool captain, but at the same time, people see the merits of it. It's a very subjective thing. I would say it should be maybe number of games played, and then speak to everyone else about being a leader as well. But that's probably just the solution that I go for, Nico.
I would say it's less about, you know, you being the best player on the pitch and the best player on the team, and more about maybe the demeanor. Yeah, the demeanor and type of player that you are in terms of the intensity. You know, we've all played sports to differing intensities, and I think there's a specific type of character that sticks out for captaincy, and that doesn't always necessarily coincide with the best talent. So,
nice. Chris, your captain preference?
No, not really. I think leaders present themselves, and even then, you know, some teams that I've seen, even some teams I've played on, there's been a captain, but a lot of leaders at the same time. So, yeah, it varies, I think.
Great question, and thank you very much for sending that one in. We'd love to know your thoughts on what qualifies a captain and what captain you want for your own side, what you look for in those men or women who end up leading your team, or something in between, of course. And we will go through them next time. It's been good to have you guys tonight. Thank you very much, Kristen, for bringing the questions along and also bringing your views.
Pleasure as always.
At khenege, khenege, well worth a look on Twitter, and he writes a lot for UMaxit, or as they're known now, Chris, after their great rebrand, TIFO.
Yes, they're changing their name. That's all I've got for you.
They're trying to get away from that. I was going to do something about witness relocation there, but Nico,
Lawrence.
Where can people find your work? Because I think a lot of people are going to want to read the Klopp article after the discussion.
Yeah, they can find me at Nico_O'Morales and find the majority of my work there. And then my articles, I usually keep them in a pinned tweet or retweet them or post them out. So yeah, find me there.
You really need a Tumblr or something. You could sort of keep them on so I can just go through that.
I used to have a Tumblr and that still exists, but I just don't have it as my website anymore, I don't think.
What's your website now?
I don't have one.
We can change that. It's been great to have you guys. If you've got suggestions as to what Nico should make his URL for the website, maybe that's StatMan.
Lawrence, where can people find you?
Around. I'll be all over at the front three and at Lozcast, LOZCAST. You can also find Adam Boltwood at Adam Boltwood and Statman Dave at Statman Dave. All of those are in the links in the description for the podcast or at the front three on Twitter, and you can see all our profiles over there. It's been good to have you guys, and we'll see you again real soon right here on the front three.
Dun, 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 dun.
Oh, good. Wow.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.